Okay, let's get going. I wrote a few things here. You don't need to copy this, it's just so for completeness. I mean, a lot of these steps are very simple. I don't want to spend time going through this or waste time during class going through this. That's why I wrote it before you guys came in. But I'll give you a very simple example. This is why I say it's the first word of symmetry. So what are the consequences on one hand and kind of the guidance on another one that we might have a symmetry in our space-time? So let's start with a very simple observation. Imagine a particle, a test particle, that has tangent u. And let's say it has rest mass m. So if you're in the rest frame with respect to the particle, you measure that it has mass m. So there's no energy, the rest with respect to u, and it has that mass. So this is a constant. So just because we're saying it's a geodesic and we have a constant mass, then our geodesic equation can be rewritten this way, right? Because it's just a constant multiplication, multiplying by m squared if you want. So this mu will give me p, and mp will give me the rp. Mu will give me the rp. So we can analyze it from this point of view, but for the sake of this calculation, let's just hit this one with a metric and lower this index. You'll see why I'm doing that in a second. So this equation implies that equation and vice versa, because the metric can be freely pulled in and out. So now we have the covariant derivative of the vector p along the vector p. And so then we just express what this is. So we know, because it's we're taking the covariant derivative of a dual vector or a covector, then remember there is a minus sign there. And then we have this. Here is a contribution from the partial, and this is the correction due to our curvature. So if you now just spell it out what it is, then that's what you have. And we're multiplying by these p's. So usually we think of that d as a free index that is adding here. But the reason I lower it in here was because we're going to slightly do something different. Rather than thinking that d is the one that is modifying these and having the addition of all the possible terms here, this first thing that what we're doing is taking that c, hitting with the metric, and raising that index. So it's the same. They are completely added up because indices are repeated. I can choose to do it in any order I want. This is what I'm going to do it. And you'll see why next. So now we have these three terms. Multiply by a and d, and everything is summed. And so this is completely symmetrical. I can relabel these indices in any way I want. And just let's look at these two terms here. So in both cases, I have a b, which I still have to do something with. But here is d, a, comma d. But those indices are completely added, summed, and independently if you want. So I can relabel this b, sorry, this a freely as a d, and this d freely as an a. I'm not changing anything. This factor in front is completely symmetric. You guys see that? And then because of that, then these two terms are the same. I can cancel them. And then I just end up with this. So if we kind of rewrite now our geodesic equations, we have the mass, sorry, the derivative of p with respect to tau, or m uv d tau is equal to this right-hand side, which has only one derivative along that direction b of GAD. So suppose you have any direction that just so happens to be such that the metric has no dependence whatsoever on that b. So then this is zero. And what we have is that the momenta associated with the particle along that direction doesn't change. So it's a constant of motion. So that's one of the consequences of some symmetry. So this is, we either interpret from respect to these test particles having momenta that is conserved, or we can also think, oh, what our requirement was that the metric did not depend along that direction. Let's call it b underscore, because we're now thinking of a specific direction. And what we require, what we imagine was happening, is that there was no dependence of the metric tensor, any component of the metric tensor, along that B. So if that's zero, then we have conservation. And what basically, or what we pictured is that the metric, we can freely change that coordinate by adding a little shift left and right in whichever way we want, and nothing changes. For the moment, it can be arbitrary in this case, but eventually we're thinking infinitesimal because we're not going to be able to say anything about with respect to the full space then. But here, let's think of that.
Sort of a Bayer's contribution from
time. No, we're assuming. We're assuming. Suppose that you're in space time where this is true. Say again? Oh, this is here. And this is there. So,
I think the reason I'm missing because it's b squared, like dimension, and dt over d tau is a velocity, isn't it? Right? There's an m squared.
Yes, here. No, that m was there, sure.
So maybe that's the confusion.
Yeah, yeah, because here this is m ua, and in the ua da produces tau. Thank you.
Why do we have an m?
So I had an m here, I had m u here, and m u there. But in order to create this d tau, I recall that this is u da gives me the d tau.
Okay.
And so then we had the m floating around.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. So this is just one kind of. And as I said, this is why I wrote here is first word on symmetry. So we're going to do more. In fact, we want something much, which is more general. We don't have to be, we don't want to keep thinking of particles. We want to see what geometrical structure would it be there available for us, or what we can construct to explore where we have symmetries or not. And there is something called Killing's equations. Eventually, we're going to get there. But I just want to kind of stress that sometimes the metric or the symmetries of our spacetimes will be very easily identifiable. In some other cases, it will not, because we may have chosen a really bad coordinate system. And I'm just giving you a very simple example here. Suppose you take flat spacetime in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So you would say, well, my flat metric is -1, -1, -1, -1. All right, that's my flat metric is this. In those coordinates. But of course, those are very special coordinates. You chose them so that it simplify your life. I mean, this is a very easy or very silly example, but just to illustrate the point, imagine that there is another coordinate, that this coordinate t is kind of mapped to another coordinate t prime that also depends on the position of where I am. So t is defined through this. And you can imagine, or you can do the transformation, just do the transformation of a 0-2 tensor using the transformation laws that we have. In this case, it's so easy that I can just take the differential of this. I have two terms, one that involves the derivative with respect to t primes times the differential along t prime, same thing with x. And if I square that and I replace this expression here, then my metric becomes much more complicated. So I will have some component along the dt prime, which is given by the square of this function. And this function could be as complicated as you care. And it will give me a cross term between t prime and x, and it will give me a mess on the x coordinate. So this is as flat a spacetime as that one. But if you were to see this one, you.
-2 f t prime and all.
Yes, sorry.
1 minus f squared.
Yes. Thank you. But this is as flat a spacetime if you were a metric as that one. And you wouldn't necessarily recognize it unless you start working with it. If you take this one, as, for instance, you could compute some invariants, you realize, oh, maybe this is sharing the same invariants on that one. Maybe I should try and look for a coordinate transformation. But, so this is just to say it's not always clear to identify even what space time you're working on, which is especially relevant given that what we're trying to do is find out a special solution. So let's go for that, for our first non-trivial special solution. which will occupy quite a bit of our time in the next few classes. So this is, we're following chapter 5. 5 of Carroll's, or chapter 6 of Wald. So we want to now write, obtain the solution under the following conditions. We want spherical symmetry. We want the spacetime to be static. And here, soon, we're going to be very careful in understanding or describing what we want by this in kind of rigorous terms. But for now on, or for the moment, let's think this is independent of time. Something which is funny, because we still haven't even defined what time, what our time label would be. But let's imagine we want to be independent of time. And also, we want no cross terms, dt, dxi. So any, we're choosing label t for our time and xi for any of our spatial coordinates. We don't want any cross terms like this.
Why is that time in quotation marks?
Because we still have not defined what time is. So at the moment, this is the part of the problem. We're building the spacetime as. And at the same time, we're introducing coordinates. And also, so we're trying to write a spherical symmetry. We're going to try and keep on this spherical sector. Let me just say clean scene flat space time in some sense. Again, this is in between quotations, because we need to still see what we really mean by this. So let's try and represent what this metric, or the most general metric that we can think of in terms of these assumptions. And also, we want to, at least from the get-go, try and simplify our lives a little bit, not to get obvious degeneracies or possible places where the metric will go wrong. Even though we're going to try and do that, at the end we're going to find that indeed we have such cases. But let me just write this, and this is what I mean by. We're choosing it to represent this way. And so this now is when we can say, well, if I think of a vector that is tangent to our t, this is where we're trying to make contact with the quotations, ddt, what's the tangent of that? The tangent of that will be, or the norm of that will be given by this piece, nothing, no contribution from that other piece. We're assuming that we say we do the mapping with a coordinate basis. And so there's no contributions from that one. This one will have norm. -1, okay, it does seem to be making sense with respect to a time-like trajectory. So then we probably said, okay, then this seems to be a good time for now. Also, we can say, well, if we take t at a given instance, t constant and r constant, so we're defining now a ball, right? And so that part of the metric will be governed by only this piece. And that ball, if we ask what's the area, we have still to define integrals. We haven't gotten there yet, but pictorially you would say, well, this looks very much like what we have in flat spacetime. We have a contribution due to the sphere, we have a radius, but then we have this piece, which basically tells us that depending on maybe the curvature we're dealing with or the scenario we're dealing with in those coordinates, the area is larger than just 4 pi r squared. There's going to be a contribution due to this one. But that's under this choice. We can try.
Or r squared there is because you want to keep spherical sector from the.
So if you want, let's do the two things. Yeah. So if we are in flat spacetime, we would want to recover flat space, because flat spacetime will be consistent with all these things that we've said here. So if alpha, beta, and gamma are zero, we recover flat spacetime. Then we want to recover a spherical sector. So at most, we're saying, well, it will be a factor multiplying everything that we know on kind of a perfectly rounded sphere. There is no particular direction there. So we have all, we want the symmetry of the sphere multiplied by something. So we're allowing our radii or our balls to have different areas, but no further structure. Also, on that, we're not allowing any cross term between r, theta, and phi. And as we said from here, we have no also cross between time and any of these coordinates. So we could start with these, but we can also do a little bit of a further manipulation using kind of like what we did there. We can ask the question, well, do we really need to live with all of this? And we simplify it even further before we actually start doing any calculation.
That was a good point. If you start with something like that, you can manipulate it in such a way that you could get rid of dt, dr stuff, dt, so that's
not always, but in some in this case you could. And what we're going to do is exactly that, but here we want to get rid of this so that we don't have to carry this function. Oh, and also, by the way, because of the way the different contributions will show up once we start trying to evaluate the Riemann or the Ricci tensor, this is the square of e to the alpha. And so because it comes in, it's convenient this way. And also dealing with exponentials. So if something is gonna misbehave here, well, then this some of these functions will get to go will have to go to infinity. So this is where we're gonna say, oh, this is our problem. But otherwise, these are usually well-defined functions.
Hey, sorry, why are we even starting with like this much generality? Can't we just, you know, define from the get-go, like, you know, we have minus dt squared and plus dr squared and whatever to make it just, you know.
Or we're not going after flat space then. We're allowing some further structures. So because we're in spherical symmetry, we're going to allow some changes to take place as we move in R.
Okay. So
which are, yeah. So this, because we're saying, thanks for the question. So the time, we said first thing, well, we didn't know ahead of time what time would be. We chose this, and then we ask, does it make it sense? And it seems to be making sense. So then on that time, or that sense of time, we're going to say, we're going to try and build functions that are independent of that time because of plasticity. A priori, we're allowing that different R constants will have associated to them different volumes or different areas. And then we, if you want, we also have worked out and in the context of trying to do weak gravity that there will be some role for some dependence in position that we'll have to keep, in some sense, this the information of the gravitational field. So if, again, we think of Newtonian theory, we have a ball of mass m, we have a potential associated to it that decays as one over r. We need to recover it somehow. This is why we're allowing that structure. But we have simplified a lot, right? This is extremely simplified. But we don't have any crosses here. It's extremely simplified, and the same thing with this one.
And wait, sorry, one more time. Why are we assuming like exponential functions? Why?
We have yet to say. I mean, for all we know, the answer to our problem might be alpha is related to a logarithmic, and so which will completely undo the exponential. This will just happen to be convenient when we do the calculation.
Okay.
That's a great point. I mean, we could have add here a of r, b of r, c of r. So the one thing I'm going to say, well, we could have tried and said, well, suppose we have a different coordinate r. I'm going to call it r for just for a second, which is r e to the gamma r. If we do that, then we can immediately say this r squared, right? And then once we take the differential of this, it will mess up this It will be a much more complicated thing. But it will not give me any, so it will just mess up this piece. This one will be clean, so let me just change it to R squared, might as well. It will mess up this one, but it will still give me a function of R in sitting here. And it will mess up the arguments inside this function. But there will still be functions that only depend on R, which have yet to determine. So might as well just write this if you want, alpha of R, beta of R for some alpha and beta, some alpha and beta that we have yet to determine. So the point, the only point I'm trying to make with this is we could have started with this representation, which now has added to one of our coordinates a little bit of physical sense. Second?
What if mapping from R, little r to big R is not invertible? Because you're changing your functions from little.
Yeah, it will be. It will be. I mean, once we do the calculation. But what the other thing is you could have said in here, you could have started from the get-go, I'm going to choose my coordinates such that the coordinate R measures spheres that have area 4 pi r squared. So that's just saying you added a little bit of extra information to your coordinates. That you could have done. Again, then you have to go through the calculation and see if that takes you to a good place.
Why could you have done that? I understand from the calculation, but for the third time, I understand that you choose R squared because you want to keep the structure of the
sphere
with a particular big R. But why would the coefficients of dt squared and dt r squared be only a function of big R? Isn't that a new claim if R is not invertible in that equation?
It will be invertible.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you could say, well, if not, but you're saying if I started from the get-go, I could have chosen that R and then say, well, with respect to that R, I want to write this. So this would have been dr squared e to the 2 beta.
Oh, yeah. In that case, yeah.
Right, so this will be our expression. And we start from here. Mm. And then we say, can we get to a set of equations that we can solve and that has reasonable meaning.
And the problem is that those two are not the same thing.
No, they are not the same thing. These are new functions. So I didn't have before what the right expression for R was. It was just simply a spatial coordinate along, if I chose t equal to constant, along directions of, for say, an arbitrarily picked origin, because we're going to be then connected to the metric outside a spherical distribution of matter that will be at the center of that. And along any of these directions, we have complete symmetry. So from here, well, we're in vacuum. I should have said that we're in vacuum. Which does not preclude the situation where, say, a metric or some star, let's start first, of a star. And so we're measuring from, we're trying to obtain this solution outside the star. We're still not making contact with the inside. And so because we're here it is true, TAB equals 0 because of vacuum, which then means we can just try and solve this problem instead. We don't need to bother computing the Einstein tensor. So what do we have? We have a metric. And for now on, I'm going to then forget about the capital R, and we're just going to call it small r one as well. So our metric is minus e to the 2 alpha. And I'm also going to get rid of the bars. I mean, this was just fluff to tell us, oh, these are different. But our starting point is this metric that depends on coordinate. And associated to it, we have the inverse metric. Okay, this is as far as we can go, making our life simple. With this, we now have to bite the bullet and compute. So I'll just leave this, or at least some of these, check. Just use the metric, use our definition for the Christoffel symbols, and then find out which are the non-zero ones. And when you do that, you find, for instance, these expressions. Which you don't need to write. They are in every single book you can open. I'm just writing for completeness here. And of course, all the symmetry combinations out of them, like theta r is the same thing as r theta, etc. And so out of that, then the next step is compute the Riemann tensor. So I'll write a couple. Again, they're all the full expressions are you can find in Carroll's. So for instance, of course. Say this one, and we only have one argument in all our functions, which is dr. So if they know with a prime, that means dr. Something that is useful to keep in mind is remember the Riemann was second derivatives of our metric tensor. So it should scale like 1 over L squared. So when you write things, it's easier. It's sometimes good to double check that you're keeping those quote unquote units. So here I have 1 over L, 1 over L, 1 over L squared checks. I have second derivatives at 1 over L squared. First derivative squared, that's 1 over L squared, so I didn't make a mistake. At least from that point of view, I don't have an obvious mistake there. This one. So an example, if we try and do the same thing, we might run into trouble. Because I see 1 over L here, but it's, oh, wait a minute, I have L here, is that correct? Well, here's where you have to be careful. The metric we're assuming has no units, so R squared is what has no units. So this is the same thing I can do, R squared divided by R, that's 1 over R times alpha prime, that's 1 over R, it's 1 over R squared. Just be careful that that mnemonic I gave you, if you're using coordinates that have some associated length to it, you have to be taken with a grain of salt. Okay, and you can finish computing all of them, and you have the symmetries. And out of these, we compute the Riemann, the Ricci tensors. Okay, so that's that. So we arrive here, and now we have to solve it. So we can proceed in any way we want. But there might be, since we see like lots of terms that are in common here and here, up to especially that thing, we might try to combine to get rid of a whole bunch of stuff. So for instance, consider doing E to beta minus alpha RTT plus RRR. So if we consider that combination, which individually, each term has to be zero. So RTT has to be zero, RRR has to be zero, because we are solving Einstein's equations, we're in vacuum. Every component of these has to be zero, right? And we have a whole bunch of equations at our disposal. Of course, many are trivial. So here we have four. But in reality, we have three, because this one and that one are the same, pretty much. So we have these three, so we can manipulate everything in any way we want. And we have only two unknowns, alpha and beta. So one of the two should be derivable from the other one. So we're saying this thing has to be zero. But this combination just so happens to cancel many things there. And it gives us something that is very simple. So it says the radial derivative of the function alpha plus the radial derivative of the function beta has to be zero. Because, of course, this one will not do it. So this means that alpha is minus whatever alpha is, has to be related by this, where c is a constant.
Wait, sorry, can you say one more time?
Sure.
Is there not an equal sign between?
No, sorry, this is just product. So I threw it that in, because this is what I have, 2 alpha minus beta. So
yeah.
This way I can get rid of that.
Okay,
so now we go here.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is it in general true that in coordinates that diagonalize the metric, the Ricci tensor will also be diagonalized?
I don't know. I mean, all the examples I can think of, you may be tempted to say yes, but I don't think so. It's not necessarily obvious to me. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, in two dimensions, yes. But in arbitrary dimensions, I don't know. Again? The question was, is it true that any metric that is diagonal will have a Ricci tensor associated to it that is diagonal? I don't know. That's a nice exercise. I'll try. Okay, so we arrive here. Before we move on, so what we find is that if you have whatever alpha wants to be, if it is related to whatever beta wants to be in this way, the difference between alpha and beta are only different minus sign by a constant, then that's fine. But that constant, we can always absorb it in our definition of, say, time. So what would adding something to alpha do? If I add to alpha a constant, will give me, say, e to the whatever 2 alpha dt square. If I now imagine that dt, remember, nothing depends on dt, on time. But if I do dt is dt times e to the minus 2c. Sorry, dt minus c. And dt square is dt prime square e to the minus 2c. So by just a simply kind of rescaling of my watch, just a change of units in my watch will allow me to absorb this c, if there were a c there. So we can throw that constant away, because it really does have no role to play. We can absorb it just by the definition of our time, which we still haven't defined. So time is just that t is some label. So we can choose that label to run quickly or slower to get rid of this constant. So we do that. So now, armed with alpha equal to minus beta, we can use, say, the equation that we have yet to use, which is this one, has to be equal to 0. And so the equation r theta equals 0 implies e to the 2 alpha is 2r alpha prime plus 1 equal check. So now we want this to be true. So I can rewrite this of the prime here as dr r e to the 2 alpha equal to 1. Which means that now if I choose e to the 2 alpha be equal to 1 minus, let me use this notation, thus that solves that, right? Because if I multiply r by this, it will give us an r here. The derivative of r will give us the 1. When r multiplies this one, we'll knock off this r. I'll have this rs as a constant, which we're purposely putting there so that we can make some contacts. And then that's our solution, which we can now combine with beta being minus alpha to write our solution. It's going to be. Say again.
Why do you want r theta to be 0?
Oh, because we're solving Einstein's equations. Our Einstein's equations are this.
Okay.
And so all components have to be 0. And so then this tells us that our solution is now and that's Schwarzschild's solution. I don't know. Does anyone know German in the room? No? Well, Schwarzschild apparently means black pit. So he was destined to find the solution. And he found it not too long after the Einstein equations were formulated in the front during the First World War. We still need to say something. So I just threw in that RS saying, oh, that's a constant, but we can do better. We can use our weak gravity analysis. If we're sufficiently far from whatever source is producing something here, if R is much, much larger than whatever this constant is, then we can make contact with our potential. And we can find out that this RS has to be equal to G to GM. Remember, we found that the relationship with the G00 component was minus 1 plus 2 phi. And so we can use that, our weak gravity limit, our knowledge of Newtonian theory, that the potential of an object that has a given mass goes like m over r, and then find this. So once we have this, I might as well replace it here. I'm going to put a G
So
yes.
this solution, right, for a Schwarzschild black hole, right?
We haven't used those words, but yes.
The issue I'm having is like the assumptions you made at the beginning were just spherical symmetry. Could you not have a spherically symmetric space that doesn't give you like a black hole solution?
I can choose M to be zero and I recover flat space time.
But if M,
great question.
But if
yeah.
M is non-zero, you have a...
Then we said that the metric in the vacuum regime will be given by that. As long as we're in spherical symmetry or static, then that will be given to that. And very soon I'll tell you that actually we just have found a lot more than that case. So, but your question is right on. If that M happens to be zero, what we have found is we have just recovered flat spacetime. However, if we're thinking, what is the metric outside the sun, let's say? Nothing else existed in the universe and the sun were perfectly static and symmetric. Mm-hmm. We also just found the metric outside the sun.
Oh, really? Okay.
So any spherical, as long as you can assume that your space time is static and your distribution of matter is spherically symmetric and you are dealing with the solution outside, that's your solution. And of course, that's never true in nature. Nature, it's always kind of not exactly respecting this, but it's the standard joke about the spherical cow. You guys show, so to the degree that we can approximate the cow by a spherical cow, then that's our solution. And that's what we'll do very soon. We're going to be taking our sun as being perfectly spherical, and then we're going to look for consequences. And one of the things we're going to draw is the deviation of the mercury of helium of mercury, which was one of the basic tests of general relativity. So a few comments. Let's see. Before we do that, let's do three more. So who in the second row hasn't done the thing? One, two, have you? OK, then we jump over there. So you start.
I'm Vincent. I watch TV shows in my free time.
Cool, and where are you from?
Oh, I'm from China.
Cool. you?
I'm Jackie, I'm from Toronto. In my free time, I listen to podcasts mostly.
Podcasts?
And I'm James, I'm from Canada, and I play the guitar in my free time.
Oh, another musician, we're good. Okay, great. Okay, so let's make some comments. So first, let me go back to her question. There is something which I'll motivate at some point. We're not going to go through the proof, but we found a lot more. We asked for staticity. We asked for the time. There to be no time dependence whatsoever on spacetime. And there is a famous theorem by someone named Birkhoff that shows that's a solution even if you relax the time independency. So as long as you have spherical symmetry and there is vacuum outside, that's our solution. It involves like more machinery to prove, but you can prove that. The other thing is that, okay, we have obviously here two problems. In principle, one are R equal to GM, and the other one is R equal to 0. Okay, do we have problems, or do we have now a bad choice of coordinates?
Before you go there, the question about Birkhoff theorem, in that case, would you have a time-dependent mass allowed, or also?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, time-dependent mass, asymptotic.
Asymptotic,
no, we would expect it to be constant. What I mean is time-dependent configuration. So I can have a collapse of a star. The asymptotic mass will still be constant, and I think that's where Aldo was going. But my spacetime is changing. The boundary of the region where this is true would be changing, yet the asymptotic solution would be the same. Now, if my mass changes for whatever reason, which would be weird because of the setup we're thinking, well, we might have a time-dependent mass, and so then there would be a modification here. But we can realize that in nature, that's a different story. So let's just think of it that way. This we have found, or this solution will be describing also the case of a star that is collapsing on its own, and on the in the process of doing so might form a black hole. So even the formation of a star that collapses will give this. Or it doesn't even want to, and if it doesn't collapse and it bounces off itself and begins to expand forever, well, the solution outside its boundary will still be given by this. Let's just, before we actually discuss it, let's just think of the scales. So problems will happen at a radius, which is given by 2 gm, or let me just use that rs. If we now ask, what is the scale of that radius, wherever this thing goes to 0 at r equal to 2 gm? OK, if we are trying to find a length out of this, I have to kind of restore powers of c appropriately so that I get a scale. And this is roughly 3 in units of the mass of the sun. Remember, that's our kind of standard rule or ruler. So the radius at which the coefficient of the both the GTT and the GRR are going to 0, in one case it's going to 0, the other one is diverging, will happen at essentially 3, whatever mass your object has, divided by the mass of the sun times kilometer. So if you we put together that the mass of Earth there, the radius at which we're going to have a problem is deep inside the radius of the Earth, where the assumptions that we took to derive this solution don't make sense, because we're not in vacuum. We're deep inside the Earth. The same thing happens with the sun. But it won't happen with a black hole. The black hole will have that radius still in the vacuum regime, and so you have to deal with it, or deal with the consequences. But we're still trying to decide, do we have to worry about those two problems? Is I mentioned something about the radius of this RS, where it might happen, where it might happen inside or outside. We argue that in the case of stars, or objects we can think of, maybe we're fine, because the place where this would be a problem would have to be inside, which violates our assumptions. But we can also entertain, well, if that's our solution, and it is, that region is still uncovered by, or not within the context where there is matter, we can try and go after it with curvature invariance, right? Just to ask questions as to whether we have problems or not. And this I already anticipated in the previous class. If you compute, say, using those Riemann tensors, go and compute the Kretschmann invariant, this which we define to be R, A, B, C, E, summing all possible indices, then you will arrive to the following. And you see that there is absolutely no problem at R equal 2m. So R equal 2m, at least out of this invariant, doesn't seem to be a problem. And if you keep computing more and more invariants, you're going to keep seeing that R equal to M is not an issue. It was just an issue of our coordinates. So what we'll do probably next week is try and draw a nice graph of what our coordinates are doing. Because we did say time is a good label for telling us what happens in time, or this T is a good label for time, but may not be the better one. It might not be the best one to describe. Maybe those problems over there have to do with an unfortunate choice of time. And maybe with a suitable coordinate transformation, we will be able to get rid of that R equal to M. And indeed, that's possible.
So in general, can we say that if the Ricci scalar does not have singularities, then it's a coordinate dependence?
So careful. So you mean the Riemann because Ricci is zero. So Ricci, so any scalar that we can compute out of Ricci would be perfectly fine. It doesn't will not have any problem. But not only on r equal to m, it also has no problem in r equal zero, because the Ricci is zero by definition. No, so it's a Riemann scalar. So, and this is something I think maybe I went too quick last time I mentioned this. So this is one curvature invariant that we can write. And this is perfectly well behaved at r equal to m. But the key is that as many curvature invariants you can think of, if all of them are well behaved, then what you have is a current singularity in your hand as opposed to a true singularity. Of course, that's maybe too many, because I didn't tell you all the curvature invariants. It's as many as you can think of. But usually, if this one is well behaved, it's already telling you that it's very likely that this is what your spacetime or that issue that you're seeing is a current singularity if this one is well behaved at that place. But it's not guaranteed. There are cases where you can see this is still fine, but then there are other ones that are blowing up.
Yeah. How many scalars can you possibly build?
Infinite.
So how could you know
that? Exactly. We don't. This is why I'm kind of being very vague on purpose, because we can't. So you just explore a sufficient number of them. And then you just feel confidence. And then at some point you begin to say, oh, it does seem to be the case that this is just a corner singularity. And then you'll begin to try and see if you can then do a corner transformation to undo that. Yeah. To undo that issue. And this is one of the things we'll do with Schwarzschild.
Oh, so the real thing is this is just kind of like evidence for it, but then to really know that it's not an issue, you have to find a coordinate.
Right. It's just necessary but not sufficient condition. Okay. Let's see, there was one in the back before, and then we come back to the front.
But I was going to ask that.
Okay. How about you?
I was going to ask if you also consider derivatives of the curvature as curvature invariants?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could have done. Okay, A, B, C, D, E. And indeed, one of those examples I was thinking when he was asking the question, we have examples where this is fine, but any gradient associated with that curvature is blowing up. So that happens, say, for instance, in extremely rotating black holes that are a verge of uncovering a singularity. And then same thing, you're not there yet, but you can already begin to see that some gradients are blowing up while everything else stays. So you're saying, well, the tidal forces are now blowing up, but this is why it's not as clean to say, oh, you have all this and you know.
So it's genuine singularity.
Yeah, that would be a genuine singularity.
At the horizon?
Say again? At the horizon.
So the truth signature seems like changes from minus plus plus plus. To
say again?
The signature of metric.
Oh, cool. Yes.
So can we interpret it as like the R?
Yes, we're going to go there. I mean, so he's going way ahead. So what one thing he's noticing a little is if I go far out, let's say at very large R's, and my signature is clearly minus, plus, plus, plus. But now if I go inside R equal to M, this one changes sign and goes to a plus, and this one becomes a minus. So what happened here? Which one is the time coordinates? And this is related to what I was saying. We're going to be able to show that the issues that we have at r equal to m that are associated to a corner singularity have to do with an unfortunate time label that is changing character inside an r. So we have to deal with that, but we're going to go there.
Can geodesics be used to diagnose singularities?
Can geodesics be used? Let me think. I mean, of course, yes. So in fact, you're going to be able to say one typical way of trying to assess where is a true singularity is find out geodesics that become incomplete. So the geodesics n are a finite parameter, you want a finite parameter. And those theorems, kind of, I anticipated the other day. Remember, oh, the equations we were discussing the other day was Rai-Chaudhry's equation. So, through, I remember I mentioned, through the analysis of that equation, a little bit of further structure or assumptions, you're going to be, this is how the singularity theorems are proved. And singularity theorems are proved using that observation. You just follow geodesics. You find if they end, and if they end at a as a finite time, then you begin to say, oh, the space time is becoming incomplete. And it's determined as geodesically incomplete, and that is a sign of a true singularity.
But wouldn't that be a coordinate dependence statement?
Oh, no, no. That's we'll see how much we can get to it, but I'll try and answer that. No, no, you can do, of course, there is some dependency in that you can choose to label everything you want, but remember here you're trying to say you're only asking for finite, not infinite. So as long as it's finite, so you could carry different clocks, but as long as it's finite as opposed to infinite, you're going to say the space-time ended here when it wasn't what it wasn't expected. So then there has to be something wrong with the manifold. There might be a hole or there might be a singularity. So something is precluding kind of the space-time in a small portion to keep going.
Well, a couple things. In the example that you were just talking about, so that doesn't happen when you have a coordinate singularity. That means when you do the when you find the geodesic, it doesn't stop at finite time.
No.
When it's a coordinate singularity.
When it's a coordinate singularity, right? It won't.
It won't happen.
Right.
Okay. And the second thing is, if you find a coordinate system that unravels that doesn't have the singularity, that's definite evidence that the singularity is not real.
Say that again, more slowly.
If you find a coordinate system in which the singularity is not present,
yeah,
therefore it's not real.
That's right.
That is definite evidence.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So in fact, we're going to
that is sufficient. Yeah.
Look for a very actually easy coordinate transformation of these that will completely get rid of the problem of r equal to m. However, the price to pay will be to break what? That cross terms.
Okay.
So we're going to leave with a cross term dtdr. But then we're good. So let me start. What are we going to do next? So armed with these, and let's imagine for the time being we're thinking about the sun. We're not thinking about black holes yet. Black holes is the place we're going to go. But we're trying to make contact with this standard test of general relativity that passed, of the theory passed with flying colors when there were tensions if we were trying to understand some phenomena with Newtonian gravity. Yes.
How do we do that if the sun is not a vacuum and we kind of want
we're outside the sun.
Oh,
we're assuming
a singularity that's outside the pen.
Good. Okay, great question. So if we take up with the sun, I can't remember what, so the sun's radius is about 50. No, it's not in the sun. What's the sun's radius? It's several, it's far more than 1.5 to 3 kilometers. So I mean, a neutron star would be 15 kilometers. I don't know how much the sun would be. But it's, several hundred thousand. Yeah, so we are way, so the radius of the sun is much, much larger than that. So we have RS here for the sun. So here is where we will be hitting that issue. We also had R equals zero there, where we'll be hitting AR issue. So these two in principle issues are there, but these are way inside our matter distribution.
Wait, that's a bad thing though, right?
No, because this is not the solution. It cannot be the solution because we don't have vacuum here. So
yeah.
We're going to make contact here, TAB, in all this is different from zero.
We can't make a coordinate transformation here and expect it to describe the sun because then trying to describe coordinates inside the sun, but that's not a vacuum.
Yeah, excellent. But because it's not a vacuum, that's not our solution. The solution for the metric tensor or Einstein's equation inside the sun is not this one. It's something else.
You can't possibly know that r equal to zero is singularity from the solution, even if these scalars diverge, because definitely r equal to zero there is. In there. So
So hold on. Well, are we talking about the sun or are we talking about a black hole?
No, not the sun. Not the sun. Just any old black hole. Because if R equals zero, there is some mass. You can't possibly write this solution to.
You could make it so.
There's a singularity of R equals zero.
We have found that solution, RAB, equal to zero all the way to R equals zero. I didn't tell you what a mass is. And the only thing I'm saying is if that M is non-zero, gravitationally, through proper testing, we're going to be able to tell that there is some gravitational field in there. You're trying, I know where you're going, and it's a good thought. You could ask the same question about, say, a monopole or an electron. You say, well, if you picture it as a point particle, then there are all sort of issues that come up. But good. What would happen is that R equal to zero, all the invariants are blowing up. The theory stops being able to tell you what you should expect, because the theory itself is breaking down. So if you want, you can take in the limit as m, so you imagine a small m, and take the limit of m as it goes to zero, size, keeping m. Right? And then you're saying, but all the way through that, you're seeing that this RAB, so imagine this, it's just growing and growing and growing.
The problem is, for the black hole, for us to know that at R equal to zero there's a singularity, we have to know, even if we know, I'm kind of not convinced, but we have to know that all the mass is at point R equal to zero.
Yes, but the
not even a smidge.
Okay, great. So let's imagine.
Because that will mess up.
Let's take what I want to do. Imagine that you say you're going to put it. You're going to put all your mass at RS. Right. We still have a nothing, but so you're saying the metric from here out. And the reason I'm picking RS is because okay, I can pick it. I can put do anything, but the reason RS goes like M, and I don't care about the coefficient that it goes in front. So now let's replace it here. And then we're computing this the Creshmann invariance right at the surface of this object. I mean, or epsilon away, so that we can say, oh, the metric in vacuum is good. So now I have this one scales like m squared. This one is scaling like m to the sixth. Together, they're scaling like one over m to the fourth. So however small you want that object to be, this thing is blowing up. So you're seeing the curvature. It's just blowing up as you make it smaller and smaller. This is the size. Make it smaller and smaller. So you see that it's a tendency of your invariant to a divergent behavior. Of course, once you go divergent, you say that's a singularity. So you can interpret it that way. There is an unbounded growth of your curvature as you approach that limiting scenario. I'm not convinced.
No.
Okay, let's try it. I'm going to answer him and then come back.
Slightly connects to that. The mass here, the M parameter, does not have to be a physical matter distribution, does it? Could it be the energy associated with the curvature of the space?
Sure.
Okay, so.
But, okay, then you have to.
In the sense of this, like the mass has to be concentrated in some specific volume, like physical electrons.
Yeah, but we also want it to be such that all the way up to there, we can ask the question using this metric, which assume vacuum. So you need to, so we could do it, the problem is we say, well, what do we know that can help curve the space-time that would have TAB being zero? Gravitational waves. But gravitational waves, which have yet to discuss, do not exist in spherical symmetry. So we cannot do it with spherical waves. So there are no gravitational waves.
Sorry, could you say that again?
So one option is to say, well, can we think of something that will curve the space-time and maintain TAB equals zero? So the first option is to think, oh, gravitational waves, because gravitational waves are true disturbances of the space-time itself. They don't need a stress energy tensor to exist. The problem is that they don't exist in spherical symmetry, so we can't make contact with this solution from that point of view.
I guess here we're trying to sort of, after finding the solution, trying to, in some sense, reconstruct the history of the space-time by saying, how could this have evolved from a flat metric, maybe. But without just trying to do that, I don't understand why we need to think about the possible source of the curvature.
No, I thought you were going into slightly different angles. So just to try and answer his question. So if I'm thinking, I form these objects somehow, yeah, I don't need to care about that. But now it's there. But he wants to say, if we put the mass somewhere, that will make it non-vacuum, right? If it's non-vacuum, I can't see this equation. I couldn't be asking a question to this metric. So my answer is absolutely. But you can imagine a progression of systems that are always vacuum. They're getting smaller and smaller. And you can see that the curvature would be blowing up, or it would be going towards blowing up. And so in the limit, you say, well, there is a case where I can think of, if you want an idealization, where there's a particle that has all the mass that is centered at the origin. And anything up to that, where the particle would be, is just blowing up. I mean, it has a curvature that is as large as you care it to be.
Finite size black hole, we don't have a singularity at r equal to zero. For
we do.
No, because for your argument to hold water, we have to say that your black hole is at the size of the black hole is very infinitesimal. So your limit to that infinitesimal point would go as 1 over m4, and it has a diverging tendency.
Right.
It is basically diverging the limit.
Right.
But if you have a finite size black hole, you can't go to r equal to
Careful, this was a specific exercise. So we're talking about now two different exercises. My exercise was make this object such that mass is changing as I'm doing this, because I'm making it always go hand in hand with RS. In your exercise, you can just pick a black hole with whatever mass. And then now at R equals zero, then you have disaster, right? Because it just blows up. But I'm answering in that to that exercise, is that, well, don't go all the way to r equals zero. Go arbitrarily close to r equals zero, and this will be blowing up by
arbitrarily close to r equals zero.
Why cannot?
Like,
no, no, inside. So the black hole, there is no surface in the black hole.
For all. We can agree that the solution is valid outside the finite size black hole, right? We agree. So inside, so if you assume finite size, okay, you have to find the solutions now inside, which are going to be different.
No, 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 hold on. It will be this one. It will
assume a non-zero stress energy tensor.
No, no, hold on.
Okay.
There is stress energy tensor is zero all the way. If you want, all the way to your idealization r equals zero. So I can ask the question. So the black hole has finite size, RS. But there is no surface. In fact, we could, for all we know, we could be in a black hole right now.
Okay.
It could be that it has such a large mass that we are not feeling the curvature. This is the curvature you're going to feel. And so if the mass is sufficiently large, you can always engineer this thing to be arbitrarily small, even weaker than the curvature of Earth. So for all we know, let's say we're there. So we could be inside. Okay, we're going to die. Fine. But okay, we're going to die at some point, sooner or later. I mean, we are not mortals. So that might be an exercise. So we do that. So we go into the black hole, and we can probe as we're going invariably to hit that r equal to zero, because this is what's pulling us. We have our, if you want, curvature meter, and then we just see it blowing up, and it's getting arbitrarily large.
How do we
as you go.
Know this from this equation?
Yes, we can.
What we wrote here was assuming Schwarzschild metric.
Well, of course, we're assuming we have a Schwarzschild black hole, and we're falling into it.
The Schwarzschild metric is just valid outside the black hole.
No, no, no. We didn't say that.
We did.
No. It's outside the vacuum. It's outside the matter.
Yeah, outside the matter. No. So inside the black hole, I'm not saying inside the Schwarzschild metric. Inside the place that there is the mass.
It's collapsing. It's collapsing on its own. So let's say, take this one, be any size you want, and be and just sit a centimeter away from it. And let it collapse.
Okay.
And then you're just riding with it till the end. And then you're carrying your thing. And so this is all vacuum all the time. And he was doing the different exercises. Let it collapse first, and then you go in. Doesn't matter. Both cases will be the same. just stay a centimeter away and then carry your curvature meter, if that's something you can build, and you're going to see it's blowing up invariably.
If it's changing over time, is our metric still time invariant?
Oh, cool. But then there is what we call our friend Birkhoff that told us you also found that solution.
Okay.
So Birkhoff tells us if it is spherically symmetric, then that solution will still be good.
So the static assumption that we had is not...
was simple for us,
yeah.
So that we didn't have to carry alpha t comma.
Birkhoff's theorem is not assuming static.
Yeah, Birkhoff theorem says don't assume static. The rest you do assume. Carry through. I mean, the rest. The cross terms, you also will be able to see that you can do a good job with dealing with it.
Birkhoff's theorem, getting rid of that static thing, and also having your curvature meter sitting in epsilon,
right,
away from the black hole while it's collapsing on itself, you can see that it's diverging.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you will be measuring it.
Saying r equal to zero is.
I mean, in the end, this. Yeah. No. I mean, your questions are perfect, right on the money, because I mean, this is something it takes a while to wrap your head around it. So the way you wrap it is by imagining that you're going, and then you idealize that point. You say, well, if it exists, is that, I mean, r zero plus epsilon, with epsilon being however small I care, then you might as well then I go r equals zero is the limit of that process.
So just by looking at the solution, the Schwarzschild solution, there's no way to know if M is coming from a matter stress energy tensor or a gravitational.
Awesome. So that's another thing that we're going to conclude. So we haven't gone yet to this to the black hole, but once we do, so this is one of the great mysteries. I mean, Chandrasekhar has a very nice phrase that is, it's amazing that they are in nature, these objects that, however you form them, are only described by two parameters, so mass and angular momentum, which we have yet to give. So let's say if there is no rotation in the universe, there's, however, and I sometimes have given this talk and said what I'm about to say, you can make them in any way you want. You can make a black hole with politicians or hooligans. At the end of the day, it's just going to be described by the same mass. And then I usually say, that's maybe something you really want to do. Right, so then it doesn't matter what you procreate. At the end of the day, there's a single parameter, that's the mass. So you could have made it with gravitational waves that collide in the right way, scalar fields, standard Mohr particles. Once you're there, the solution doesn't.
Can you feel better?
Any other questions? Yes.
When we want to describe the curvature inside some mass distribution, will we have some equivalent to like Gauss's law with like some massive charges and some boundary fluxes?
There is something similar. You have to be careful, and usually it's asymptotically, not locally, but there is something that we'll grab onto as well. For that, I mean, and to do something that we then assign to physics, we need the second war on symmetries. So we're going to be able to construct a tensor, which is the scaling tensor. And associated to some of them, we're going to then say, oh, they are familiar concepts that we can do by using those tensors combined with the stress energy tensor distribution to give us global notions of things that we were familiar with.
Another quick one. Isn't the black holes being described only by a single parameter, or I guess maybe two? Is this another way of rephrasing the information paradox, because we can't say anything about how they were formed? Or?
Right. In some sense, this is related to that, what you just said. I mean, this is, okay, we're going way ahead, right? So let me just, for completeness and given that we don't have a lot of time. So as far as the math is concerned, and in four dimensions, we think there are three parameters, mass, angular momentum, and charge. And astrophysically, it would be hard to expect a black hole to be charged, because if it has some particular charge, and if we assume that the universe is symmetric, there will be charges of our signs nearby. The black hole will pull them, and it will neutralize itself. So then we think it's two, mass and angular momentum. We haven't described the angular momentum case. That's a curved black hole, which if we don't see, you're going to see very likely in the course you take in January with Ruth Gregory. So then that's it. But as you did what you just said, okay, there was a lot of information when we formed a black hole. now we only have access to a small subset of parameters. Where did the information go? And this is where kind of semi-classical discussions try to recover it and then fail. And then you use further structures to say, well, there is a problem. Some people say that. Other people say, well, I don't know what happens inside. For all you know, there might be a portal some other direction. Or if you are able to account for the amount of information that is in what we now call the singularity, but when we resolve it might be something else, and maybe we're done. But this is a matter of a lot of discussion. And then associated, yeah, no, let me not go there. So then I'm gonna, we'll be going way up. So let me just say a few things here. Where in the world did we assume four dimensions? Because this will be something that maybe I can comment later on. We assume four that we're living in 3+1 dimensions, kind of in the structure of the metric, but it's actually sitting here, sitting there, right? Because we have two dimensions of the sphere. Nothing stop us from considering as many dimensions as we want in the sphere. So you can write r-dimensional black holes, are spherical symmetric, etc., with very much the same calculation, except that you're going to pick up higher powers of that r. It will show up. So what you find is that the solution would be essentially this one. With here, there might be kind of a larger dimensional sphere. And the only thing that will change is, so this one will have a power here, which is different from 1 over r. The reason I'm bringing this up is because soon we're going to discuss geodesics. I might as well also discuss what happens if your spacetime had larger dimensions. There is something you have to worry about, because then you will not have stable orbits for particles. So just kind of to see a preview of what we're going to do next. But again, we're thinking back to the sun. So we're going to be thinking around the sun. We're watching something, in particular Mercury's orbit, or we might see starlight coming to us, like the first efforts to measure light bending through during an eclipse, and also redshift. So we're going to look at these three main tests of general relativity. Very recently, the three traditional tests. So for that, what we need to do is take the solution. First, think of something that's happening outside the sun. Great, we can do that. And compute geodesics. So if we're thinking about Mercury, so Mercury is a space will have a time-like trajectory associated to it. So we can just imagine the Mercury as a point particle that is going around the sun. So we need to find out what the time-like geodesics are. And if we're looking at starlight that we're going to measure during a solar eclipse, then we're going to also need to find null-like trajectories. We'll discuss how to solve the geodesic equations. Okay, so we're going to spell this out using this metric for both these cases. So we're going to either think of UA satisfying it to be -1 or 0. So this will be for the time-like case. For the space-like case, so we might as well write this as epsilon, and we'll evaluate it to be -1 or 0. As we need for that case. The equations of motions are complicated, as you know, because you're going to have to involve all the Christoffels and everything, but we can simplify it if there are symmetries. So in particular, given what we started today's discussion with, there was one symmetry that we very readily associated to a particle if the metric satisfies some property, right? We said if the metric does not depend on a particular coordinate, there is a symmetry associated to that, right? So what symmetry do you think we have here that we can easily identify? That's one, good. What other one?
Translation.
Right?
Translation.
Exactly. So we the statisticity assumption. So we remember we just wrote what was it? The so we or no, we wrote this dpu d tau equals to zero if the
so let's just call
p.
Are you using this because you said using Birkhoff's theorem we all need to have the static assumption? So
what we're saying is that okay, good question. So if we have Birkhoff's theorem, we don't need to use static, right? But then we go find the solution, and we find that the solution outside the distribution of matter
static.
Is static. Then we can use it.
This is weird.
It is weird. If you're going to believe Einstein's question, then answer questions force you. You can find the outcome of your computation is something that it happens to be static. And because of that, then we know at least that dpt will be zero. Dp, d tau along component time will be zero, which means that that component, pt, is a constant. And that will be the energy of the particle. So the symmetry associated to the time. This time vector, which again we're going to associate with this Keeling field. Again, this is coming next class. We're going to have that. Then associated to spherical symmetry, there will be angular momentum conservation. And we're going to use those two quantities to simplify the expression of this. And once we have it, we are off to the races. What we have is the trajectory of a particle in a given potential. And we're going to then discuss what happens and then use that to both draw kind of tests for general relativity, but also discuss the properties of our space-time metric along the way. I think I'll stop here. Say again? Sorry. Yeah, so this one has an under that underbar made it different, but yeah, thank you. Any questions, comments? No? Okay, we'll stop here then.